I am very, very grateful to all of you today for joining us. Please give a hand to our next first speaker, Tom.
So thank you, and I apologize beforehand for those of you who've heard this all. Hopefully there will be some new stuff so you're not completely bored. But you know, one of the things that happens is you get into a meeting like this and a lot of things are dark and unpleasant and anti-life. But, and whenever I go into this, I always have to like choke my way through it. There are things that happen still that are for life. And one of them was I had the birth of my seventh grandchild just this morning. So we now have five grandchildren, boys, and Margot is the newest grandchild girl. The other thing I want to say is when one does the, you know, like hundreds of talks and public speaking and webinars and writes now 7 or 8 books, there are mistakes that I would say one makes, but what I mean is I make. And there are sometimes mistakes of interpretation or mistakes of references or mistakes of perspective. And so I think I had an insight that I have been, had a mistake in interpretation for the last 18 months of this situation. Basically saying that there was no pandemic. And the reason I was saying that, for instance, is if you look at published statistics, there was a state or a district in Germany. So the death rate in 2019, in May, was about 7,400. And then the death rate in that same state where they keep very careful all-cause mortality statistics, May 2020 was 7,300. In other words, it went down. And then the death rate in May 2021, in other words, 4 to 5 months after the injections, was about 8,600, meaning it went up, meaning there was no pandemic. And another experience of the same thing was, you know, I go to give a talk at Joel Salatin, some of you probably heard of him, Polyface Farm. I have a conference and I'm speaking at, and Joel and I are walking around. And Joel says, you know, this past year and a half, we've been devastated by COVID. And of course, when one hears that in the midst of a pandemic, you think, and what I asked him, yeah, so a lot of your people got sick and couldn't work and died, and you know, he's 50, 60 people. Oh no. We didn't have even one sick day in the last 2 years. Not one sick day. But what happened was, because they had a no enforcement of mask policy and anything like that, they basically lost their business. And Joel was so committed to only local business that they basically couldn't survive. And so his whole philosophy of a business of local food was devastated and nobody was sick. And then I saw an interview with a quarterback in the NFL who was the NFL MVP last year, Aaron Rodgers. And as I was watching this and I was hearing how he was shamed and othered and humiliated, and they made him wear masks when nobody else did, and they made him show up at 5 a.m. every single day to get tested and then wait in the car until the test result was positive or negative, whereas the quote vaccinated could get a test every 2 weeks and come right in, and on and on and on. I realized at that moment that we are in one of the worst pandemics ever. And it has nothing to do with a virus. It has nothing to do even with what you would call a sickness. It has to do with the fact that, my friends, we're living in a cult. I don't know if the cult has a name. I call it the virus cult. And it has all of the earmarks of when, of what happens to people, like particularly the crown jewel of being a human being is the ability to think. And all of you know that when what's happened in the last year is we have essentially chosen to not think. So you get things like this, and you hear people all over the place saying, facts don't matter. So you'll have somebody and you say, why did you get a vaccine? So that my Aunt Bessie doesn't get sick. And you say, here's what Fauci, here's what Moderna, here's what Pfizer said. They have never studied anything to do with transmission. Never studied it, let alone shown that it actually prevents transmission. You show them the facts, and then you say, well, why are you getting the vaccine? And they say, so that my Aunt Bessie doesn't get sick. And so there's this sense of like profound discouragement that if human beings are going to choose to not think, where do we go with this? Now, it's interesting for me, having just said that, I am now going to try to present you with the facts, even though I said facts don't matter. But you, my friends, have to know the facts and how to present them. Otherwise, it's my core belief, human beings need to think. They need to see the truth. The truth shall set you free, no matter what it is. And if there's anything I hope can happen in ArcLight, it's a center for people to come together without any preconceptions, with everything on the table. Let's come together, because nobody has the truth themselves. Let's come together as well-meaning people and put everything on the table, and I mean everything, and see if we can figure out the truth. Now, with that said, I am now going to say, here are the facts about the central question for me in this, which is, how does a virologist know there's a virus and show that it causes disease? Like, I was called to be interviewed by a guy at BuzzFeed who wants to do a story on what an idiot Tom is. And he's the science writer. And so I asked him, how do you know this? He has no idea. So once you know this, and you know the facts, I think you can see how everything fits into place. So, and by the way, I have a booklet that I passed around, and it costs $10. If you choose to pay the $10, please pay it to ArcLight, because I don't want it myself. You can also just take it if you want. So, how do we know there's a virus? Now, if you ask most people, they say, well, we know because a lot of people get sick in the same place. Or because a lot of people got sick in one place, and then it spread to the next place, and that proves it's a virus. Or because, like the guy from BuzzFeed said, well, there's an overwhelming consensus of scientists that there's a virus. So, of course, I asked if he took a vote. And what percentage do you have to get in order for that to be the proof that there's a virus? Or, well, nobody was sick at San Quentin, and then somebody went there, and then everybody got sick and tested positive, and that proves there's a virus. Or my Aunt Bessie went to church, and then she got sick, and she came home, and then Uncle Fred got sick, and that proves it's a virus. I've heard hundreds, maybe thousands of stories like that. Those are called epidemiological observations. Nobody who knows anything about science would say that that's how you prove the existence of a virus or that it causes disease. The role of epidemiology, these kind of observations, is to generate theories which you can then test in a laboratory. And besides, if you think that because a lot of people get sick in the same place, that proves it's a virus, you must think Hiroshima was a virus. And if things spread from one place to another and that proves it's a virus, you must think Chernobyl was a virus. For hundreds of years, they saw one sailor after another getting sick on ships. Their teeth fell out, they went into heart failure and died, and they quarantined them and said something contagious was spreading around, and then somebody ate a lemon or a lime, and the whole thing went away because they had scurvy. So we have a long history. Beriberi, pellagra killed millions of people. They thought it was contagious because it happened in families, etc. I don't need to hear any more stories about Aunt Bessie. That is not the way you prove that there's a virus. Is there some water I can have? Okay, let's go to the next step. And here I'm gonna, for those of you who haven't heard this, this may be shocking to you, but I can tell you it's a fact. It is a fact. There is not one published study in the medical literature where they found this thing. Remember, a virus is a thing. We're not talking about a feeling or a concept or an idea. It's a particle that you can find. The prototype is a bacteriophage, which have been found thousands of times, same size, same shape, same composition. You can easily find them and demonstrate them. There is not one published paper in the conventional medical literature of finding anything you could call a pathogenic virus from one sick human being or animal. Did you get that? There is not one case where you can look at somebody with chickenpox and do the chickenpox lesions or measles and test their snot or AIDS and find HIV or COVID and find something called SARS-CoV-2. Not one. The electron microscopist for Luc Montagné, who is credited and got the Nobel Prize for discovering HIV as the quote cause of AIDS, said in an interview in 2006, "We never saw an HIV particle, only cellular debris." There is not one published case. Now, let me tell you the people who agree with me on this. So number one, a friend, Christine Massey, has done Freedom of Information requests to now 135 different governmental institutions, the NIH, the CDC, the Ukrainian Minister of Health, the British, every single one. We have 135 written letters. They're in the Christine Massey reference. You can find it in the end of chapter one. Every single one has said, we have no record of any SARS-CoV-2 being found in any biological fluid of anybody we say has COVID. And many of them say the same thing with HIV, Ebola, smallpox, measles, mumps, chickenpox, Zika, on and on and on. There is no published study of anybody with chickenpox finding a chickenpox virus in any biological fluid from that person. Here's another group that agrees with me, and you can see their written replies on Christine Massey's site. The six leading authors of the papers that say the isolation and characterization of SARS-CoV-2 from people with COVID, we asked them, did you isolate and purify the virus and show it? And in writing, they all said no. And then about 6 months ago, I was asked to present what I'm saying now to a group of international lawyers. I'm sure you've heard of Fulmick and Kennedy and a whole lot of other people, and they were unhappy with me dividing the movement, and so they wanted me to present this, and there was two virologists as part of the conversation, and they invited a guy who they introduced us as the senior virologist pathologist for the Wuhan Center for Disease Control in China for 20 years, and after that, he was 20 years senior pathologist at Yale University and head of their laboratory pathology division. And he was there to say, Tom, and Andy Kaufman, who I invited to join me, are wrong. So I presented what I said I'm going to say to you today, what I am saying to you today. We had a conversation afterwards. We said, do you agree that there has never been any uniform, morphologically identical, characterized particle called a virus from any sick person? He said yes. Why not? There's not enough virus to see. Now think about that. This virus that's going to kill us all with an electron microscope, you cannot find one example of it in any human being who's sick, of any virus. So Andy had the presence of mind to say, what about, there's this thing called a viral concentrator. What about if you mix 10 people's fluids together, right? Their bronchial fluid. Would you then have enough virus to see? And he said, no, you have to concentrate it. What about 100 people? No, there's not enough to see, you have to concentrate it. What about 1,000 people? You mix their bronchial fluids together. Would you then have enough virus to see in an electron microscope? And he said, no, there's not enough. 10,000 people, mix 10,000 people's snot together. There is not enough virus to see, and then he wouldn't answer any more questions. So that is a fact, my friends. There is no published cases of anybody finding a pathogenic virus, a uniform particle, we're talking about a thing, from anybody who's sick, any fluid. So the question is, why are there approximately 10,000 papers with the title something like The Isolation and Characterization of SARS-CoV-2, that's the virus, Zika, Ebola, HIV, you know, smallpox, etc. I have 5 folders like this. Many of those papers are in those folders. I've read almost every single one of them. So what are they talking about? There's 10,000 papers saying isolation of the virus. Here are the 3 pillars that modern virology is based on. So what happens is, and this started in 1954 with a guy named John Enders, because at that point they knew they could find particles the size, shape, morphology, and composition of a virus called phages or phages, but they couldn't find any of these pathogenic viruses. Enders saved the day by inventing the viral culture. Here's what he did. He took snot from somebody with measles. He didn't purify it or isolate anything. He mixed it with milk. He mixed it with horse serum, fetal calf serum, bovine embryonic fluid, and then he spread that on African monkey, green monkey kidney cells. And then he took away the nutrients of the culture, so he starved it. And then he added 2 antibiotics, which are known to be toxic to the kidney cells. And then the kidney cells broke down into all these little particles. And he said, I've now cultured, i.e. isolated the virus. That is what is called in every single study, every single isolation. That is the first thing they do. Now they use gentamicin and amphotericin, 2 antibiotics, antifungal, which are specifically poisonous to kidney cells. They spread those on African monkey, green monkey kidney cells. They see it break down into particles, and that is called isolation of the virus. Now, what's interesting is Enders in 1954 decided to do a kind of control. So he did the entire experiment, the horse serum and the calf serum and the streptomycin and the penicillin and taking away the nutrients, except he didn't add anything from anybody with measles. And you know what he said? The results were indistinguishable, meaning the breakdown of the kidney cells, which is called the cytopathic effect, CPE, that is the proof that viruses exist and they cause disease. Is that clear? Cytopathic effect is the proof that the virus exists and causes disease, and he did the entire experiment, didn't add anything from anybody with measles, and it broke down in a what in the word he used, indistinguishable. And nobody repeated that experiment until now. So my friend Stefan Lenka and my friend Andy Kaufman and I decided to repeat that experiment. Actually, Stefan decided to repeat it, and Andy and I joined him to have a bunch of talks about how to do it. And what we did was see this central question: is this breakdown of the kidney cells that we call the proof, is that because of what we do to the culture, or is that because of a virus? So you will see on page 13, if you have the book, you see the results of that experiment. So in column one, we took a culture, and you can see on day five, it grew normally. Right, page 13, it grew normally. Fed the culture, no antibiotics, no fetal calf serum, no virus, nothing from anybody who's sick. And it grew normally as you would expect. Then we added fetal calf serum, a small amount of antibiotics, and kept the nutrients the same. 5 days later, it grew fine. It was totally normal. No cytopathic effect. You with me? Vertical column three. We did exactly what every isolation experiment in the last 50 years has done. We took away the nutrients. It's called Delbecco's minimal nutrient medium. We added the same concentration of gentamicin and amphotericin, just like every isolation experiment. 5 days later, the culture broke down into all those pieces, showing the cytopathic effect, showing that the virus killed the cells, the proof of the existence of the virus, but there was never any virus anywhere near this culture. We proved that the cytopathic effect is simply and easily understood to be only because of the way they do the culture. It has nothing to do with the virus. And here's what's interesting. I tried to figure out how much money has been spent on virology in the past 50 years, and I don't know the answer, but let's say $1 trillion. This entire experiment, I happen to know because I raised all the money from some of you, contributed, I think, and a bunch of other people, $42,000. That's how much this costs to do, to disprove virology. Now, then once they do this culture, and here at the very back in the appendix, you will see a picture of the results of the culture. We're talking page 41, and you see an arrow. And then the second leg of modern virology is you see this culture, you do this culture, you see these little particles, those are SARS-CoV-2. What you will find when you read this appendix tonight is that the CDC said those exact particles were present in 1973 from kidney biopsies, lung cancer cells. They are simply the breakdown of our own cells and tissues. There is no possible way that any virologist can distinguish between a, quote, virus from the outside versus the inevitable breakdown into tiny little particles from the breakdown of our own tissues when something happens, like we get poisoned or something like that. And in fact, if you read viruses May 2020, is there any way to distinguish whether this thing that they're pointing to that says this is SARS-CoV-2 comes from the outside, is a pathogenic virus, or from the breakdown of our own tissue? They say, quote, in a review, quote, however, to date, a reliable method that can guarantee a separation from what they call extracellular vesicles or exosomes, that means breaking down of us, versus outside viruses, does not exist. Nobody can tell you whether these things are coming from the outside or from you, because the reality is, the fact is, they're all coming from you. And then the third leg is they say, well, once we do this culture and we have all these little pieces of genetic material, right? Say you have genetic material in us, in bacteria, in fungus, in whatever, in your lungs, and it breaks down in the culture, and so you have billions of little pieces of RNA. There is nobody who has ever found anything that would be called the genome of a virus in that brew. They find little pieces, they chop them into other little pieces, they arbitrarily throw out some and not others, they put them together like a puzzle piece in the computer, and they say, now we have an in silico, which means inside the computer genome, which is never exists in reality. So we decided, we being Andy and Stefan and I, to see whether we could prove that this is a fraud. So you go back to page 13, and you see vertical column number 4. And what we did was we did the entire experiment, the tissue culture, took away the nutrients just like they do, added antibiotics, gentamicin, amphotericin, it broke down into a million pieces, and then we added RNA from yeast. No virus, no bacteria, just pure RNA from yeast. Then we put it through the same alignment process called unbiased, de novo, next generation sequencing, also called metagenomic sequencing. And what did we find? We aligned and made the entire SARS-CoV-2 genome. Even though at no time could it have possibly existed in that mixture. And the next step, which we haven't done, is we are going to show that simply by adding RNA from yeast, we can then find the genome through this alignment process of every RNA virus ever, HIV, Zika, measles, et cetera, because none of them exist in that mixture. Those are the facts. There is no virus. There has never been a pathogenic virus. It is a materialistic misconception that has now been disproven, and you can see the evidence here. This means there is no reason to do social distancing or wear a mask. There's no virus, there's no lab-created virus, there's no engineered virus. They are making bioweapons to inject into people. Those actually have a name. They're called vaccines. They've been doing this for 60 years. By the way, a measles vaccine is a measles, is you take the unpurified snot, put it in a cell culture, it breaks down, you inject that into people, that is a measles vaccine, period. Ask your doctors, ask your anti-vax people, how do you make a measles, a live viral vaccine? They won't know. Because of this truth, fact, that there are no pathogenic viruses, there's no lab-created viruses, there's no immunity to viruses, there's no immune system to test, there's no PCR test to test for a segment of something that doesn't exist. There cannot be antibodies, either vaccine-induced or natural antibodies, to something that doesn't exist. It's nonsense. I think my time is up. I only want to say, that my hope for this space is a vessel for the truth. Not that any of us have the truth, we don't. But if we come in and leave our prejudices and preconceptions at the door and say, what have you come to understand, my friend? And show me the evidence. It could be evidence from your own understanding or from your own insight or from your own heart. And that's fine. Or it could be things that you can't possibly know yourself. And so then you have to do some science. Both of those are fine. But to say because so-and-so believes it or most people believe it or that's not what I heard in third grade or because Aunt Bessie got sick, that's not how we're going to get out of this mess. There are a lot of people who are interested in that. I hope that's what can come out of this. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Comment, which is that the cat's meow of all of this is that the final proof of the existence of the virus is a PCR positive. At the end of all those experiments, they claim to have found it, but it's a tautology. They don't have the thing they're looking for.
So here are the three premises to do a PCR. That means polymerase chain reaction. That means they can't find the whole genome. So they break it into little pieces called primers, which are about 1/100th of the genome. They have it stick to sequences in the mixture, which they can't find, so they amplify it, which means double it. There's three premises of a PCR procedure, which is one, you have proven that these sequences actually came from this virus. Right? If that's not true, then you can't possibly do a test. The person who came up with the PCR, his name is Christian Drosten from Germany.
Gary Mullis. Oh, this PCR.
This PCR, not the original. The PCR for SARS. Here's a quote from his paper describing which primer sequences to use. Quote, "We aim to develop and deploy robust diagnostic methodology for use in public health laboratories without having virus material available." They were looking for an elephant without ever having seen an elephant, so they found a piece of a hoof, and they said, if we amplify that enough, that must be an elephant. So that's the one condition. The second condition is you have to prove that these sequences only came from the virus and not from anything else. Otherwise, how do you know whether you're not testing for sequences from a human being? So people have done blast search, which means they search the genetic database, and all of the PCR segments used in SARS-CoV-2 testing have been found in at least 93 human sequences and 91 microbial sequences, meaning it is a fact that we've proven that these PCR sequences did not come from a virus. There is no evidence for that at all. The third condition is, in order to do any test, you have to know what the error rate is, otherwise known as false positive and false negative. So for instance, if you do a pregnancy test, you can take 100 women who are pregnant. How do you know? Because you can feel and see the baby in there. And then you can do a blood test, and if 99 are positive and one is negative, you have a 1% false negative rate, right? And then you can take 100 men, most of whom are not pregnant, and then you can do the same blood test on them, and if one is positive and 99 are negative, you have a 1% false positive rate, right? That allows the clinician to use the test. Without that, you cannot use the test. because you have no idea whether it's accurate or not. Because there is no so-called gold standard of finding the virus, because it's never been done, because even you think about this, isn't an infection a viral culture? Don't they tell us that the virus, which you can't see, gets into your lungs, reproduces itself, makes millions of copies, and then goes into the lung fluid? Why isn't that a viral culture? What's the difference between that and putting it into a cell culture? The only difference is they know they can make the monkey cells break down into these so-called particles, and it doesn't happen in your lungs. And therefore, there is no virome. Anybody who speaks of a virome, you should run out the door. Because there is no virome. There's just little pieces of genetic material which they're calling mistakenly viruses, of which there is no evidence. We're talking about garbage. We're talking about when cells and tissues break down, and I'm way over my time.
Can we take one more question?
Yes.
Yes.
Tom, question for you regarding spike protein. Is the spike protein a thing?
Spike protein is a synthetic engineered toxin, and that's the whole point. I never said they can't see, there's the good news. No matter how much they try, they will never make a contagious virus because it doesn't work like that. Those things are not contagions. You can, however, make a toxin and inject it into people and make them sick. We've been doing that for I don't know how many years. That's called a vaccine. All of them, no exceptions. Tetanus, measles, mumps, all of them. Smallpox, all of them. Biological toxins meant to make people sick. Now I'm really done.
Dr. Tom, I just have a quick question. Why do you think the PCR is testing positive for all these kids who have zero symptoms?
PCR measures how much you're breaking down. That's what's called a viral load. That's what's confused the doctor. So you poison somebody, they break down. Oof, it looks like you have more viruses. Viruses are garbage.
But even if you have no symptoms?